Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. Why do monkeys belly flop, elephants mudslide, and rats play fight? In his new book, Kingdom of Play, science writer and professor David Toomey set out to answer these questions. You might be surprised to learn that the scientific literature is a little skimpy on animal play, far skimpier than the number of viral videos of crows sledding or animal friends playing together. We'll hear from Toomey on how to define animal play and how to understand why animals do it. And of course, we'll hear from you about animals you've observed and wondered about. That's all coming up next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. David Toomey's new book, Kingdom of Play, takes us to some wild places. Dreaming as play, octopuses bouncing balls, the way exotic birds romance each other. But I want to start with something a little more familiar to us all. The absurdity of my beautiful, tiny idiot dog, Laszlo, and his little buddies, Typo and Fava. When he gets around these similar-sized friends, they can wrestle and chase each other and mouth each other's legs for literally hours. And then he'll flop exhausted onto our bed after a play session like that and set his head down, letting out a big old sigh, and fall asleep immediately. And I look at him and I think, man, that's an enormous amount of energy to expend. Like, in the wild, he'd have to eat like two rabbits to make up for the calories he expended just playing with his friends. And I wondered, what can he possibly get out of that, aside from sheer joy? And if it's just sheer joy, is there room for that in our theories of biology? Here to answer that question, we've got David Toomey, author of the new book, Kingdom of Play, What Ball-Bouncing Octopuses, Belly-Flopping Monkeys, and Mud-Sliding Elephants Reveal About Life Itself. Welcome, David.
Thanks.
So, David, what's my dog get from all that messing around?
That's a great question. That's the question that evolutionary biologists ask themselves when they look at the behavior of play. And what Laszlo gets, you started to talk about Laszlo. I hadn't known you were going to mention. I had a dog friend named Laszlo.
No!
Yeah. Yeah, and he figures in the book briefly. But I could talk about that later. What dogs get is probably socialization. A lot of mammals, social animals particularly, grow up to be healthy, cooperative, social, good, mature adults when they play.
Kind of only if they are allowed to play in normal ways, right?
Yeah, evidently. There have been so many studies with rats, decades of studies with rats, and rats deprived play were quite maladjusted, asocial as adults. They were either too terrified to play with others or altogether too aggressive, so others would not play with them. But what Laszlo gets at the very least is socialization and probably some other things.
Yeah. You know, I think sometimes when we look at animals playing, whether it's, you know, in YouTube videos or it's our own pets, we think like, oh, I get that animal's playing. You know, we just sort of take a look at the look on their face and kind of how they're doing. And we kind of just gestalt impression, yes, like that animal's playing. But of course, scientists who are studying this, they can't go by just kind of the general impression. So you adopt this kind of four-part test that a scientist named Gordon Burghardt developed, right?
Yeah. Burghardt needed a strict definition. And what he came up with is that for an animal to be playing, the behavior has to be obviously unconnected to anything to do with survival. Another criteria was it had to be voluntary. You can't force play. There's no such thing as forced play. The animal had to want to do it. Another criteria was that the behavior had to be repeated, but repeated with variations. And that would distinguish it from the stereotyped behavior sometimes you see in ill animals, rocking back and forth or pacing. And finally, for an animal to be playing, it has to be healthy and well-fed and well-rested. You put all those things together, and you can be pretty sure, so says Burkhardt and many others, that you're seeing play.
And so then using that definition, different, it's ethology, right? It's a study of animal behavior. So they've, these ethologists have gone out, and they've found animals playing kind of way more places in the animal kingdom than you might expect.
Yeah, a lot of people, I mean, I think all of us would expect it, no surprise, that dogs play, cats play, all the big mammals we see play, the squirrels in my backyard play, we see birds playing. So mammals and birds, I think we've long known that they play, but scientists have found play in reptiles, turtles, for instance. They've found play in fish, which is fairly surprising, I think. They've found play in octopuses. Maybe that's not so surprising because we've long known octopuses are genius and very smart. And 2 years ago, a group of scientists found play in bees.
How do you even measure how a bee would play? I mean, that seems like a very difficult, like, experimental setup.
Yeah, I mean, measuring play in animals that are so unlike mammals is quite, it can't be obvious, right?
Yeah, can't throw a ball for a bee, yeah.
No, but what they could do was set up a kind of a maze in which bees were able to pass through one part of the maze that was strewn with wooden bee-sized balls, and another part of the maze which was empty, and on the other side of this whole setup was food for the bees, bees that were not playful would go straight for the food and not bother with the balls. But a lot of the bees, even when they were hungry, that is, hadn't eaten in a while, stopped to play with the balls, to roll the balls around. And some of the bees rolled the balls around a lot. And that certainly looks like play.
We're talking about animal behavior and play with science writer and professor David Toomey, author of the new book, Kingdom of Play, What Ball-Bouncing Octopuses, Belly-Flopping Monkeys, and Mud-Sliding Elephants Reveal About Life Itself. Of course, we would love to hear from you. I love a few animal anecdotes. What kind of animal play have you witnessed? What have you found kind of funny or curious or amusing about it? Something you don't understand that an animal that you've observed or that you are the owner of, in the language of our day, one of your pets, one of the things they do. You can email your anecdotes to forum@kqed.org or your questions about these animal behaviors. You can find us on all the social channels, our digital community, or you can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Who doesn't want to tell a story about their dog on the radio? David, one of the interesting things that you noted in the bee section, but also it comes up a lot in different parts of the book, are the kind of variation in playfulness across an animal population. Like, we all know this from our own animals. Some dogs are more playful than other dogs. Some bees, as you noted, are more playful than other bees. What do we make of that? If it's something that is good for animals to play, that there is this kind of variation in their willingness or interest in doing it.
Well, one thing we learn, I think, obviously, animals are individuals. In any group of animals, some are going to be more playful than others. And that variation if I want to talk like an evolutionary biologist, I think that that variation is very good for the population as a whole, because play is a kind of an experimentation of behavior. And like some experiments might turn out well and some not so well. But every now and then you'll get a new behavior and maybe a new kind of play that leads to the improved survival of the group.
Here's a question that I've kind of long wondered. You know, how do we describe the internal state that an animal is experiencing while playing? You know, like, would we call that fun? Like, when we look at animals playing, I think we oftentimes place human interpretation on it, and we say, oh, they must be having fun, you know? But can we say that?
I'm not sure we can say that. We don't. I'm not sure myself what fun means for any of us. There is neuroscience that describes and investigates what a neuroscientist would call the pleasure centers of the brain. So if you want to get neuroscientific about it, you could say fun is the activation of the pleasure centers of the brain. If you would rather be more philosophical and lyrical about it, you might say, my fun is maybe not your fun. And fun, the concept of fun itself transcends our language.
I mean, I'm thinking about an article I actually wrote, which you cited in the book, called, the title of which was Science Can Neither Explain Nor Deny the Awesomeness of This Sledding Crow, which it involves a crow in Russia with a lid, literally like snowboarding down a roof multiple times. You know, of course, the crow could fly down. You know, the crow doesn't need to put its legs onto a lid and slide on the snow, but it did it repetitively. And I feel like it really brought up for me in that article and this deeper question of sort of what is the motivator of that behavior?
Right. Well, one explanation is the desire to put oneself at a disadvantage. When I was a kid, there was a steep hill in our neighborhood. And we loved nothing more than rolling down the hill. Why? Just to get dizzy. and
there kids were, still do it. Yeah,
kids still do it. And there, and certainly more efficient ways of getting down the hill or back up the hill. We were, I think, deliberately upsetting our sense of balance. And to speak as an evolutionary biologist again might say, we were doing that so we might learn to recover the balance. To get back to the crow, maybe something like that was going on.
We're talking about animal behavior and play with science writer and professor David Toomey, author of the new book, Kingdom of Play. And of course, we want to hear your stories of animal play that you've witnessed, whether you saw them in your own backyard or on the internet that you're curious about and how to make sense of them. You can email us forum@kqed.org or give us a call 866-733-6786. We'll get to some of your calls and comments right after the break.
At Star One Credit Union, everything they do is in your best interests. They want to make banking easy and help your money grow. So Star One invests in technology to provide you with the best digital banking experience. Need a mortgage, auto, or solar loan? Their rates are stellar. At Star One, they're all about building lasting relationships by providing financial products and services that put you first. Become a member at staronecredit.org or drop by any of their Bay Area locations. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with science writer and professor David Toomey, author of the new book, Kingdom of Play, What Ball-Bouncing Octopuses, Belly-Flopping Monkeys, and Mud-Sliding Elephants Reveal About Life Itself. Let's bring in Christine in San Jose with a great story.
Alexis, love your show. I just wanted to mention, I had the opportunity to go to the Galapagos Islands last fall, and we were snorkeling with a group of 10, and we got to swim and play with felines. There was a feline that stayed with us in our group, and we were kind of in a circle, and the sea lion really didn't have a way to get out, but just swam up to one of us and then spun around and went to another one and then spun around and did it again, and we probably played with them for 10 or 15 minutes.
I'm so jealous of all of that, by the way. I was just looking at the Galapagos. There's a lot of stuff about Darwin in David's book, so I was like, the Galapagos. Maybe we could go there. That sounds amazing, and thanks for bringing us that example. David, I feel like in a case like that, it does feel like particularly interspecies play. It's like a fascinating thing because it could be discovery, right, as you put it. It could be sort of like trying to figure out its environment. But once an animal does something kind of repetitively in a low-stress way, it does feel like then it verges into what these scientists would call play.
Yeah. And a second to your envy, I'm also envious playing with sea lions in the Galapagos. Seals, I mean. Interspecies play is fascinating, and that is something of a surprise, I think, to scientists that species far apart on the phylogenetic tree are able to play with each other. Because when you play, you have to, in some sense, understand each other. You have to know what the rules are, mm-hmm. If there are any rules, and you have to accommodate each other somehow or other. So how do you do that across that barrier that separates species? I don't know, but many animals are able to do it.
Yeah. Let's bring in another fantastic example of that. Nadia in Sunnyvale, welcome.
Hi. So I have a fish. Her name is Ruby, and she's really playful. Like, when I come to the tank, she kind of swims around kind of happily, and then she likes to follow my finger, and I can see that she's kind of happy about that. And then sometimes I'll put, like, a pellet on my finger that she eats, and I'll, like, cover my finger a centimeter or so above the water, and she'll like to, like, kind of jump for the food because I think she finds it fun.
Oh, man, that's really cute. You know, we've had a fish for like 10 years. I don't think it's ever done anything interesting. So I appreciate your excellent training skill. I do have a question about this. Thank you so much for that call, Nadia. My question is, when we train an animal to do something like this, like let's say the dolphins at SeaWorld or, Nadia's betta fish, like, can we call that play? Like, if we've taught an animal to do it, can it still be considered play if it fits this Burkhart criteria?
Yeah, I think so. The animal is still volunteering to do it. The animal isn't. We're not forcing the animal to do it when we're teaching that animal. So I think Nadia's fish is playing.
So interesting. I want to come back to something that you said, kind of explaining rolling down the hill. And this kind of gets at the dynamics of what play is and what it might do for life. You said that it kind of disorients people for a second. Everyone kind of remembers this. You roll down a hill, and then when you stop, the world's spinning. Or you spin around in your parents' office chair. Same kind of thing happens. In the book, scientists call this self-handicapping, right? Like you kind of you do a thing to yourself to make it kind of more difficult, make life more difficult. And that seems initially counterintuitive.
Yeah, right. The idea of self-handicapping in play came from a study of piglets. And a group of scientists were observing piglets in a semi-wild environment, and the piglets would often run around fast. Obviously, good behavior, good training for escaping from a predator. But every now and then, one would stop and just perform a flop over, and this just didn't seem good for much of anything except becoming a predator's dinner. So as they thought about it, they began to realize, naturally, pigs don't run on even ground. for most of their existence. They run over uneven ground and ground that has roots and stones, things you're going to trip on. So the flopover, it's not great practice for running on even ground, but it's really good practice for running and recovering from a fall on uneven ground. Mm. The canine Laszlo I knew performed play behavior, which was quite inefficient. He would lie on his side and push a rag doll across the floor with his face against the floor, mm-hmm. and do it over and over again. It would take a long time. This is not how to move a rag doll across the floor. Really, that's not what Laszlo was really interested in. He was really interested in a new experience.
Mm. So it's so interesting because, you know, when I think about animals playing, sometimes two dogs, you know, when they're kind of play fighting or wrestling, one of them will get in, I think what would be called in the book, a supine position, right? You know, they're kind of lying on their back, just sort of like a little bit exposed. And sometimes I think like people put that in a dominant behavior context, like, oh, that dog's dominating the other one. But it does seem oftentimes like it's more a self-handicapping strategy, like they're making sure that the game will continue by, you know, particularly a big dog and a little dog, say, by not kind of squishing the little dog and instead lying on their back and fighting from that position.
Yeah, that is what it is. And dogs play fighting, take turns lying on their back. One will go supine, and then maybe a little later the other one will. Mm.
So interesting. Here's another example from one of our listeners that probably required a little bit of self-handicapping. Alan writes, while observing wildlife in Yellowstone, I saw many interesting animal behaviors. On one occasion, I was fascinated by a grizzly cub playing with an adult coyote for about 15 minutes under the watchful eye of Mama Bear. Oh, man, all these things are going to make us jealous, David.
Yeah, you know what's occurring to me as I'm hearing these stories is that how much we may be missing. Mm. There's a lot written about animal play and interspecies play, but that one I haven't seen. Don't know anything about. I've not read anything about that.
Before we go to some other calls, I think you know it also brings up another kind of key point from the book, which is we know, or at least we think we know from our own animals, that younger animals play more often. You know, everyone knows puppies, you know, you got a puppy and everyone goes, wow, a lot of puppy energy, you know. Is it like an ironclad rule of biology that as organisms get older, they play less?
It's not ironclad, but there's definitely a tendency. And the explanation, the natural selection explanation might be, younger animals are getting used to their bodies. Mm. So a lot of their play is particularly a very frisky puppy or a pony will play alone. As an animal gets used to its body, it needs to do that less. Mm. But it's something of a mystery in animal play, or has been a mystery in animal play, why adult animals continue to play. Mm-hmm. Because that can't be for training, because they are well-trained already. I mean, training for adult behavior.
Right. They're confident in the things that organism does.
Yeah. What it might be for is continued socialization, because you can't. They're comfortable with their bodies. They're comfortable with most things in their environment, so they don't need to play with objects anymore so much. Mm. But they still need to play with others, because others are still the unpredictable thing in their environment.
I do love that theory that play allows us to encounter these unpredictable situations and kind of manage them before we have to, you know, right. In a more survival-oriented context. Let's bring Jane in San Francisco. Welcome, Jane.
Good morning. So I moved into a house in Sutro Forest in about 2015 and had to rescue two ravens out of an outside elevator. They were stuck there. Anyway, they moved up to the trees around my house and sort of finally moved onto my deck. They spend quite a bit of time there. But during the pandemic, there's two ravens, Rosie and Ronnie. But during the pandemic, I was playing music loudly in the kitchen, baking cakes, you know how it was then. And Ronnie, the male, started to dance to the music. So I went out there and I was dancing with him, and he was completely mimicking my foot, you know, tapping. He'd tap his foot, I'd twirl around, he'd twirl around. Anyway, he would flap his wings, he'd start singing to actually on the beat. But he was very particular about music. And finally I realized what he really liked was Taylor Swift. Yes, and I'm in my 70s, so it was a little embarrassing. But luckily, I don't have many neighbors, but we had so much fun.
Oh, my gosh. Jane, what's his favorite Taylor Swift song?
Yeah, but he loves to dance.
Oh, my gosh. Wait, Jane, what's Ronnie's favorite Taylor Swift song?
Well, it was it wasn't the new ones, but he likes all of them now. But he likes music with a certain beat.
Huh.
But I've got photos of him. He'll flap his wings. He makes a clicking noise, he circles, he taps his foot, but he'll mimic exactly what I'm doing. And the other bird, Rosie, who's very dignified, just looks on in horror.
Very relatable. Very, very relatable. Jane in Sutro Forest in San Francisco. Wow, what an awesome story. One of our producers just said, I want to be Jane in my next life. I think we can all agree there. David, what's beautiful about this one is you have things in the book about bird song as being play, but there is an entire genre of animal video on the internet, which is birds dancing. Usually it's, I think, parrots and pet birds, and less often ravens, but that's so cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Jane's got a whole other new kind of interspecies play there.
These stories are so incredible. I mean, it really does go to your point, which you make in the book and you made on the show, just that, gosh, there's so much animal behavior happening that's unobserved in any official context, right? That is just... But it's interesting because there's actually a long history of this, you know, stretching back into the 19th century, of using these kinds of anecdotes piled up and, you know, contextualized with what science knows, right, to make sense of the deeper rules or ideas of animal play.
Yeah, I mean, it's... How one uses or should use anecdotes in this study. It's been something of a controversy, and there's been a push and pull on that.
Yeah.
You simply cannot just disregard these stories.
And Darwin, right? I mean, Darwin and his collaborators, particularly around animal behavior, really did use them, right? I mean, they published books filled with them, right?
Yeah. Darwin's protege, George Romanes, published a book on animal intelligence, and it was rife with anecdotes. He was criticized for that a bit much. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the 20th century... behaviorism, that ism that not everybody approved of, came to the fore, and one was it made, I think, a lot of scientists pretty skeptical about studying animals or observing animals in uncontrolled conditions.
And that was kind of the idea that you could do stimulus response conditioning of dogs and animals and all that kind of stuff. Under laboratory conditions that mimic nothing like what animals actually encounter in the wild. I mean, obviously I'm not team behaviorist here, Kathy writes, I witnessed ducks swimming down a stream at the foot of a rushing spillway that had turned into tiny rapids after a night of heavy rain. They made their way up the side of the stream, rested on a rock, and then jumped in and rushed downstream on the rapids. This was repeated over and over again. Let's bring in Scott in Martinez. Welcome, Scott.
Yeah, hey there. I guess this is another instance of birds dancing, sort of. But I was telling the screener that I have an office here in Martinez, and we had a peahen who used to hang out in front of the office, around the office for like a good year. And one day a turkey came along, and they kind of started to get into this kind of like West Side Story kind of back and forth
dance battle
with each other. And the turkey like slowly backed the peahen like into a trash can. And then when the peahen had nowhere else to go, the turkey just took its wing and just went whap, you know, like across the peahen's beak. Actually, I sent you guys the video that I posted on YouTube. It's got like 100,000 views. But of course, somebody told me I didn't direct it very well, and I was like, they're animals, you know. But I was just, we've always been wondering, like, okay, were they playing? Were they fighting? What were they doing?
Such a good question. Thank you for that, Scott. We'll also post the YouTube video places if people are looking for it. I mean, play fighting is such a fascinating thing, David Toomey. I mean, you go over different, you know, rats play fight, dogs play fight, and they seem to sometimes have different kind of goals in that.
Yeah. Rat play fighting is in some ways a misnomer in that it's not practice for fighting. It's practice for sex. Actual rat fighting is mean and vicious. They go for blood. They attack the face or the rump or the tail. But rat play fighting, the rats are only trying to nibble the nape of the neck of the other rat, and certainly not break the skin. And that move, that is nuzzling the nape of the neck, is what an amorous male is how an amorous male approaches a female. And if you, some of the other moves are the same. I mean, there is the supine position, there is the chase and run away. All of that goes on. But in the rat play fighting, enables rats to have sex. If they didn't do it, they wouldn't know how to do it.
Right. I mean, you say, I think in the book you say that they kind of try to mount from the wrong end if they don't get an opportunity to play fight.
Yeah, they very badly need to play fight.
We are talking about animal behavior, play, why animals do it, what they do. We're taking your calls and comments, gathering these amazing anecdotes of animal play from across the area and the world with your stories. I'm joined by science writer and professor David Toomey, author of the new book Kingdom of Play, What Ball-Bouncing Octopuses, Belly-Flopping Monkeys, and Mud-Sliding Elephants Reveal About Life Itself. And getting your stories of the animal play that you've witnessed and found curious, funny, amusing. Give us a call, 866-733-6786, or you can package up that anecdote and any associated YouTube videos and send them to forum@kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for more right after the break.
At Star One Credit Union, everything they do is in your best interests. They want to make banking easy and help your money grow. So Star One invests in technology to provide you with the best digital banking experience. Need a mortgage, auto, or solar loan? Their rates are stellar. At Star One, they're all about building lasting relationships by providing financial products and services that put you first. Become a member at staronecredit.org or drop by any of their Bay Area locations. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
Welcome back to Forum. We're talking about animal behavior and play with science writer and professor David Toomey, author of the new book, Kingdom of Play. I have to ask you, David, what is your favorite example of animal play, like your favorite to watch?
That's a hard question to answer. There's, I don't know if I think the most spectacular animal play, which I have not seen, but I would like to someday, is Montague's Harrier. Yeah. The Montague's Harriers will drop catch. That is, one will fly ahead of another and in its talons it will hold a tuft of grass or twigs. A second will fly behind it and a little below and catch that tuft of grass or twig as it falls. And that they... I don't know if there's anything more spectacular than that kind of play in the animal kingdom. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. You know, we have another bird question here. Eric in Douglas City, welcome.
Good morning. We love your show. My name is Eric, and I have a property near the entrance to Joshua Tree National Park. And I got to watch a committee of turkey vultures playing in the wind over about a 5-mile area. And they'd fly in, do a flip, and then catch a thermal and ride back and do it again. And I watched them for about 25 minutes one day.
Man, I love it down there. Such a beautiful spot. I know exactly what you're talking about and love it. Eric, thanks so much. You know, interesting, birds riding on thermals is actually kind of one of those animal behaviors that seems like it's kind of right on the boundary, right, between things that are very obviously play and things that might have a variety of causes or that, you know, animals are doing for a variety of reasons. What do you think?
Yeah, that is a tough one. Darwin thought that birds riding on thermals or what was he? He was talking some kind of bird which was... just gliding. He thought that was play, but some of it might be hunting behavior. I mean, hawks circle slowly, very high in the sky, but they may be hunting, not so much as playing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, why not both, you know? I'm sure it is very fun to ride on a thermal if you're a bird.
That's, you know, as I finished that sentence, I had the same thought. Yeah, why not both?
Let's bring in Brett in Cupertino. Welcome, Brett.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, sure can. Go ahead. What's your question?
My question is we seem to put a lot of human definitions like play and stuff like this on animal behavior when I'm not sure, you know, we're putting them in the human place instead of us in their place. Mm. Like a Rorschach test, we see the human body, like in the moon, we see a face. Mm-hmm. And I think animals might be doing something totally different that is not play, but it could be something totally unrelated to play. It could be their own thing.
You know, Brett, it's a really good question. I come down fairly strongly in this camp, but on the opposite side, that the, you know, we sometimes say, oh, it's as if the dog is enjoying things, you know, and I end up saying like, well, we are mammals. We're all drawing on this same evolutionary lineage. Can we not look at another animal, even especially one like a dog, say, that we've co-evolved with and say, yes, I recognize an emotion in what this dog is doing? I know this is a long time. David Toomey, you in the book, you described the long time back and forth around, you know, what's called anthropomorphizing. Where did you land with it on how much we can say, how much we can apply our human labels and ideas to other species?
Yeah, I'm not sure I have landed. I might be right now, I might be agnostic on the whole question. Mm-hmm. Certainly, emotionally, I do feel a connection, but there is a part of me that wants to be, I'm afraid, the behaviorist kind of scientist, but also, I think the listener makes an interesting point. Maybe it might, what an animal might be doing, maybe it isn't play as we know play. Maybe we need another word for that. And I think that idea is kind of exciting. In the book, I talk about Charles Foster, a British veterinarian who tried to become various animals. His book is called Being a Beast. And he lived or tried to live as, among other things, a badger.
Yeah, that section was amazing.
So that's a real kind of curiosity and courage I can only admire.
Just for listeners, I have to tell them about this a little bit. First of all, this man went going around, you know, eating earthworms. So many earthworms that he developed like a kind of typology of earthworm flavor. In addition, he developed, you know, he was going around at night in the mud. And one of the most fascinating observations he had, which I think proves that he got to some other realm of human experience, was he began to see smells as having a shape. And that early in the mornings, that shape around, like, say, a tree would be kind of lying on it. I think he said, like, a tarp. And then later in the day, the earth heated up, those smells would get sort of more diffuse and hover away, further away from the ground. Totally fascinating. Also bonkers. Hard to imagine anyone actually doing it. But I think I take the point that it is essentially impossible to become an animal or even to understand what I think people in this realm call the umwelt, like the way that an animal would see experience or reality based on, you know, their particular kind of set of senses and tools. Let's go back to the phones here. Let's go to Ana Maria in Sacramento.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, sure can. What's your story?
Oh, good. Well, you know, people don't tend to think of insects as being playful, but I had a friend who literally was playing peekaboo with a cockroach. This cockroach would stick its little head out from behind a cabinet, and my friend would look at it, and then she would hide down, like cover her face and hide down, and it would pop up its head, and then she would pop up her head, and it would hide. I mean, it went on for a long time. We couldn't believe it.
I mean, it takes a certain kind of person to see a cockroach in their house and go, you know what? Maybe we'll play some peekaboo, you know? Ana Maria, thank you for that story. I mean, honestly, what that story gets at for me, David, is even animals that are very far away from us on the evolutionary tree, even animals that have, you know, entirely different neural structures and that we think of as animals without a lot of, you know, cognitive capacity, when you get these stories from out in the world, and this happens not just on the show but all the time, people have kind of amazing stories about the intelligence of animals in their environments. And it does make me wonder how widespread this kind of play behavior really is.
Yeah, me too. And I'm hearing all these stories. I keep coming back to the question, what are we missing? Mm-hmm. and I worry that maybe we're missing a lot. Mm-hmm. I think most evolutionary biologists would be very, very surprised. No one expected bees to play. I won't say no one expected bees to play. I have an entomologist friend who I asked if she thought bees played, and she said, I think they do, but don't tell anyone I said that.
I mean, that's the thing. When you talk with people who work very closely with animals, they have a lot of folk theories about what's happening, I think. Even you know, very intense scientists. Here's a question here. Here we go. We have two dogs, a Bichon poodle lap dog and an athletic border collie mix. The poodle was never interested in toys, balls, playing fetch. And after we adopted the border collie, a year later, she was always trying to get the poodle to engage and play with her, but he wasn't interested at first. However, over the next few months, he started roughhousing and chasing her, and now they play all the time. It's really seemed like the poodle was taught how to play by the border collie, and it's been so interesting to see a whole different side to his personality we may never had experienced had we not adopted the border collie. Another listener writes, my dachshund played fetch with herself on the stairs if she couldn't find a playmate. She also initiated fetch with other, much bigger, unfamiliar dogs. If those dogs didn't respond quickly, she'd continue to present the ball. Another example, Sarah, we have a kitten who's now 6 months old. He was brought into the house with two other cats who are about four and our dog who's eight. The kitten is extremely playful. He's tried to get the other animals to play with him since he joined the house. The dog was at first very annoyed, but the kitten kept at it, really wanting to play. Gradually, the dog has softened and now will initiate play with the kitten and they chase each other through the house. Lovely to see. Those three examples are all kind of animals transmitting I don't know if it's too far maybe in this case to call it culture, but it's they're transmitting a sense of play to each other across species, across ages. What do we make of that sort of ability to kind of learn a different sort of play from another animal?
Well, I guess we have to acknowledge animals are flexible. Those animals anyway are flexible, and play behavior itself has to flex, because in all the behaviors described in all those anecdotes, there were rules about being too hard, about where the ball should go and where the ball shouldn't go, etc., etc. So it's not a vague, fuzzy kind of learning, really. When you really drill down and look at it, there are specific things that have to be taught there. And as to your mentioning culture, I'm not so sure that isn't culture. Mm. If we're conveying behavior with really reasonably rigid rules connected to that behavior, and we're teaching, one animal is teaching another to do it, I know some people would say, how isn't that culture?
Mm. Mm-hmm. Oh, man, gets a good one. Here's a great example of self-handicapping at play. Ray writes, a doe would stash her fawn in our backyard in the Oakland Hills. Our young cat coaxed the fawn out to touch noses and run around in the yard. The fawn would splay her legs to reach her nose down to the cat's nose, and our cat would lower his body into a submissive pose in front of the fawn. It was such a pleasure to watch them. You know, I think going back to our earlier question about, are we anthropomorphizing? Are we reading too much into this play, or are we projecting our notion of play onto animals? It seems to me that animal friends, one of my favorite categories of things in the world, interspecies play, that is to say, the fact that non-human animals figure out a play space together seems to me evidence that there is something that we share with each other across species. That it's not just a human thing, right?
Yeah, it certainly does. They share a space. They accommodate each other. They recognize each other's vulnerabilities or weak spots, and each of them, the cat and the fawn, were working with each other to have fun.
I love it. Jennifer in Marin, welcome.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I love this forum. My dog and I go to Stinson Beach, and we do a 2-mile walk to Bolinas and then 2 miles back. And one day on the walk back, which is, like I said, 2 miles, mm-hmm. we spotted a sea lion in the water who was really close to shore. My dog, who loves to jump in the waves, spotted the sea lion. And the two of them, my dog, who's a sheepadoodle, she was so excited. She was jumping up and down, responding to the sea lion. The sea lion, to me, was somehow responding to my dog. And the sea lion followed us close to shore, for a good mile. And they seemed both so excited. The sea lion was, like, on his back and floating up and down and bobbing in the water and looking directly at my dog. And she was looking directly at the sea lion. And it felt like they were just having so much fun, but I'm just projecting, I'm sure, but it was just really cool, really beautiful. And I was like, oh, they're soulmates.
Your dog, Selkie. Jennifer, thank you for that story. You know, bringing it back to the human here, you know, one listener writes, as a human animal at 80 years old, I'm relearning the value of play to keep improving and maintain the skills of balance and mobility that I had learned and forgotten because they were unused or not used enough. I'd question the assumption that older animals do not keep playing to maintain some of their skills as well.
You know, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Go ahead.
The research isn't absolute on that, but older animals do need to keep playing. It's just that I think it's fair to say they play less on average.
One final thing that we should get to here is just that you draw you basically show that play is sort of adaptive in these kind of evolutionary terms. Like, it is in fact good for animals to do it, right? I just want to make sure we don't leave that key point of your book on the table.
Oh yeah, it's good. Fun can be good for you.
Do you find yourself playing more now?
When the book tour is over, I will. I promise myself.
Couple other examples here. Tara writes, I absolutely love watching otters play, and I like to imagine that they enjoy the water. Mary writes, I used to live in Miami, and for a couple of years, I had an iguana, quote, friend, who used to sit on a branch on a tree outside of my window. I would play classical music for her, and she seemed to like it and expect it. Wow, I have an interesting one there, too, because I think reptiles are oftentimes left out of the play conversation, right?
Yeah.
One last one from Caroline. Turning the question of why animals play around a bit, why does it make us so happy to see animals play? I'm also happy to see children play, but like any parent can tell you, sometimes when you take the kids to the playground, there's times where you need to turn away because it's loud, there are dynamics you don't like. Animals don't seem to have those complications that we can observe. I think, David Toomey, you would say they kind of do, right? Sometimes the play can turn into a dominance display pretty quickly, yeah.
Yeah, sure. That can be a fine line. But another thing that's wonderful about animal play, they seem to know where it is. When dogs play fighting, when one bites too hard accidentally, what he'll do is back off and maybe go supine. And that's to say, hey, sorry, didn't mean to. My bad.
Yeah. We've been talking about why animals play with David Toomey, professor and author of the new book, Kingdom of Play. Thank you so much for joining us, David.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.